Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Cheaper Than Therapy, a podcast that journeys into conversations that demystify, destigmatize, and desensitize what goes on both inside the therapy room and in daily life.
I'm Vanessa Bennett.
And I'm Danae Logan.
And we are seekers, soul sisters, and holders of sacred space. Every week, we sit down for soul-provoking conversations with fellow seekers, thought leaders, change makers, and even real people during live coaching sessions as they navigate the hard work it takes to be a human.
This is Cheaper Than Therapy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Cheaper Than Therapy. Today, we have Miss Alexandra Roxo on the podcast, and what a lovely conversation. I love that we just like continue to expand our circle. We bring in all these amazing, intelligent, soulful, feeling, depthy women. And I just feel like the circle, the community gets bigger.
Yeah, I love her. I think there's something about just a really brilliant, soulful woman that just like makes me like, yeah. Since we were talking, there's so much about her embodied state of being that I just found really inspiring and exciting as she's speaking.
Yeah. Shout out to my friend Sophie Jaffe for introducing me to her work, because I've been kind of following her for the last year and I've been very excited for her new book to come out. So that's why we got her on here today. So her new book, Dare to Feel, A Transformational Path of the Heart, is actually today. It's her pub date the day we're recording this. So you should go check that out. But she's also the best-selling author of Fuck Like a Goddess, Heal Yourself, Reclaim Your Voice, Stand in Your Power. And yeah, she's got a podcast and she does a lot of like one-on-one stuff. She's amazing. She's a force for sure to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
Enjoy the conversation. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Cheaper Than Therapy. We're so excited that you joined us today, Alexandra. So excited. So excited. Your book is beautiful. And we want to dive right in and have a juicy conversation with you about it. And we'll tell you, the listeners, all about it in a minute. But, you know, I guess the first thing that we always start with all of our guests is really just like a how did you get here, right? Like, how did you become who you are? Take us through that journey to kind of land us in the moment, the present moment.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. It's actually my pub day today that we're filming this. So I was like, oh, thank you. Yeah, I was like, oh, it's kind of feels fun to be able to sit and hang out with you all. And you're my talk show for today. You're my good morning, America. I don't even know. I don't even know that show anymore, but you know what I mean.
No,
yeah, so... You know, I was thinking about this actually when I was in the shower. It was just a few minutes ago. But I had this beautiful gift from my mom of being introduced to my spiritual path at a young age. And partially, like, my dad's Brazilian and my parents divorced when I was 5. And so I went through spending kind of half time with dad and time in Brazil with the Catholic family, and then time with my mom in Georgia with a very Protestant, Southern Christian kind of family. But my mom was like sort of secret, like had Louise Hay books on her shelf and like was very like 90s new agey, and partially because she had wounds to heal and she had life experiences and traumas to heal. And so she was in pursuit of that at a young age. And so, you know, I was listening to Carolyn Mace and Louise Hay in the car with her when I was a kid, you know. And I got introduced to my first spiritual mentor when I was 12. And he was this incredible man who was in Tennessee on a farm called the Rainbow Crest Farm. And he had like long white hair. And he was a medium, so he could kind of speak to the other side. And he, over the years, many people wanted to interview him for TV and all this stuff. And he always said no. He really wanted to just keep his practice really outside of the kind of fame and fortune and like sparkly Hollywood kind of a thing. But we knew kind of that lots of celebrities went to him, and it was just like this hush hush thing. And he would have a waiting list for 2 years out of like people who wanted to sit with him. Anyway, he taught me about karma. He taught me about, you know, he was like, look, you came to this life, you have, he said, I had a dream last night. You came to this life and you're on a stage, and you have all these rocks hanging off your body, these like heavy rocks. And I keep telling you, look, you're gonna have to take those off one by one. It's gonna take work, but that is your liberation. And so he taught me that at a young age. And I sort of began to understand my life through this spiritual context, which more I would look at as like my soul work. He was already teaching me about my soul work at a young age. He was like, yeah, this is what you're going through with your dad and your mom, and these are your spiritual lessons. And so the context that I kind of came into my life with was that, which was really awesome. With the, you know, the Catholic side over here and like the Bible belt over here. So like the Catholic side, I would go to Brazil in the summers and I would like wear a little string bikini and like shake my booty and like with my cousins in Brazil. Then I go back to Georgia and I would do that stuff and they'd be like, you're a sinner. And, you know, I was taught that like, if I masturbated, it was a sin, you know, if I kissed a boy, it was a sin. So that, like, I got these double indoctrinations, which was kind of a part of the magic sauce of me, is that I have both of those. And then this kind of spiritual core. So throughout my, you know, 20s, I was really on my spiritual path, meditation, yoga, pursuing different spiritual lineages, all while expressing myself artistically. And I was in the film and TV world. I actually went to NYU for film and TV, which I realized that learning how to express through your body, how to get rid of some of your, let's say, physical conditioning, your posture, your vocal tones, the faces that you make, all of that is very similar to what we do in healing context. And that was even happening as I learned my own practice of embodiment. It was like, I came into my teacher's room and it was like, where am I carrying my physical trauma? In my shoulders, in my voice, in my clamped jaw, right? And in order to be an artist and an actor at the time, I had to liberate myself from that one by one with a lot of practice. So I work with women now in doing very similar work, but in a healing context, they're not all actors, you know, but it's very similar. So, but I pursued like a film and TV career. I directed a web show called Be Here Now-ish that was really fun, got lots of press, got me, you know, big agents. We pitched it with Oscar-winning producers, but it was a little ahead of its time because people weren't really familiar. I was like going into HBO to pitch about the satirical side of meditation and Kundalini and ayahuasca and Tantra. And this was like, you know, 12 years ago. And so the execs at HBO, they're kind of like, huh, that's hilarious. But it hadn't caught on to the mainstream yet, right? So, but, and I also like directed commercials for United Airlines and for, oh gosh, terrible thing. And eventually I was like, I had this kind of strong, like, ooh, it's time for me to change paths. And it actually came in an ayahuasca ceremony that I was sitting in for 3 nights. It was like, yeah, your work now is going to be in healing and more directly. You're not going to hide behind a script or a character or like, you know, this isn't going to be just like a side part of your identity that you keep in the closet. And then like the, you know, marketing person from the ad agency comes up to you and goes, "Ooh, I heard it's a full moon," you know, like,
yeah,
it's going to be, it's because she knows like I'm the witchy one, you know?
Yeah.
This is going to now be part of your public identity. And that was terrifying at the time because I thought, oh gosh, all the Hollywood people are going to think that I've gone nuts and like I have fallen off my rocker. And then I made the transition. And as I became more deeper into a space of working with women and healing around their bodies, sexuality, finding voice, all these kind of things, it flowed. And I'm sure you all know, like when something feels like in life, it flows, you're like, okay, maybe this is what it's meant to be. So that's kind of how I got here. And then I've been on this path for the last, I guess, since 2016. So yeah, the last 8 years where I've been working with women in a healing context, one-on-one through coaching and mentorship, leading retreats, writing a lot about my own healing journey as an entree and a portal to invite people into discussing theirs too.
I love it.
Oh my gosh. So many things.
I hope that wasn't too long. That was like,
perfect. There's just so much about what you said that's already exciting me. And well, first of all, I'm so struck by your mother having these teachers that you're being exposed to at such a young age. And there's a little bit of like a closeted element. I think, you know, something I talk a lot about is like, there were years where I was a yoga teacher and I never said the word God because I didn't want to activate people in the wrong space who weren't ready to, I don't know, have conversations in the way that you're describing. And something I think about a lot because I'm a vegetarian is like, you know how like children who have parents that are vegetarians will go through a period where they're like, no, I'm going to eat meat. And then a lot of times they will like return to it later in life. And I'm curious if you feel like there was a point where you just did a lot of questioning around what you were exposed to so early, or if you felt like there was like a reckoning that you had with like, I don't know if these like fundamental truths feel true for me, or if I need to go on like a discovering something different for myself. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. Like that differentiation process, right? It's like, okay, like, do I need to go carve my own way and see what's true for me? And I feel like I did that with Christianity because that was such a big part of my life growing up. And so I did get to kind of explore what is Christ consciousness? Like, is this book, the Bible, even a real thing? Or is this a bunch of stories that some dudes came together and wrote? So I went through my own journey with that for sure. And I have gone through my own journey more in the more in the recent years around kind of new age practices and like what's beneficial, what's not, what's actually, you know, bypassing and completely disembodied. And so I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't say that like, I'm like, you know, Louise Hay's a hack or something like that. I still feel like she's amazing because she had really intense childhood trauma. Like she's one of those people that transformed like the dark, dark, right, of deep childhood sexual abuse into her whole healing journey. Are there problems in the new age space? Absolutely. Like tons of them. But so I've had to kind of look at that. And more recently, when I felt like the wellness world, it like was really loving and accepting to me, to look at, wow, am I now a part of this kind of like club that feels a little bit exclusive or super white or that, those kind of things. And that was, you know, kind of my recent journey. So I would say my early 20s, yeah, I was asking about Christianity and like, am I a Christian? I grew up Christian. Now I wouldn't identify with that, though I like recently just did a beautiful Mary Magdalene pilgrimage in France while I was pregnant. And I have a deep, deep love for a lot of Christian stories and mystics. But I do think in the last, I would say like little chunk of my spiritual path, it's been more of like, what practices in these different domains, even in like Tibetan Buddhism, which I've studied, feel true and act, or which ones feel oppressive still? And how do I sit with that? And where do I find myself within that? So that had nothing to do with my mom, Danae. It's like more of just like later on my journey. But I do think like the stuff that Bobby taught me when I was 12, it has stuck. Mm. I believe it 100%. He's like, look, you got classrooms in this life for your soul. You're going to sit in them. Sometimes you're going to repeat them. I'm like, okay, got it.
God bless Bobby. I feel curious about asking you a little bit more about spiritual bypassing, because I feel like the time we're living in where there's so much polarization and just like othering happening, certainly on social media, all the places, I'm struck by something that you're saying that feels really true for me around so many of the spiritual teachers that have been so supportive of me in my journey. I think a lot of the principles that they speak to, I hear people describing as, these are forms of spiritual bypassing. These are ways that people are not in the embodied experience of what it is to be alive. And what I think is challenging a lot of times is that I feel like there's a way that as we're sort of pointing the finger at people and saying what you're doing is bypassing, there's a lot of like not allowing people to be in their process, meaning I'm sure there were points in my journey where I was bypassing something and that's kind of where I needed to be a little bit because I wasn't ready to sort of be confronted with whatever I wasn't ready to be confronted with. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. I actually have a story about this in the book where I was called out for spiritual bypassing. It's one of the first ones and it actually inspired me writing
this. I'm glad you're talking about this because I actually had that written down as the one that is the yoga story because I'm so interested to talk about this.
The one where my teacher is like, you're hiding behind the mask.
Hide your spirituality. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I was young and I had found yoga and I felt like, oh great. Like, I feel like I found a little home. I feel safe here. I'm going to wear all white. I'm going to like namaste. And my amazing shamanic alchemical Scorpio, incredible teacher who's now a director in Hollywood. And we're still really close 20 years later. She was like, called me out in front of a room full of people and was just like, you're hiding behind your spirituality. What's underneath? The way she worked with me is the way, not with that same languaging or intensity, but it has informed the way that I've worked with women. But at the time, I didn't have the resource to look at some of my childhood trauma. You know what I mean? Like you said, like sometimes we have to find something. It's like a handrail. Like it's like we're crossing a river and we need something to get us to the other side. I felt so, oh, yoga, meditation, this is super helpful. I did not have the capacity at that time. I was a baby, you know, I was 18, 19, to go, wait a minute, I've been through things that are, you know, reasons that I am, let's say, a little bit more closed down, or that my body is in a particular way, or that emotionally I don't feel safe, or that I have trouble letting people into a certain, whatever those things were that I've acknowledged in the last 20 years of life and therapy and love and all of it. Yeah. But at the time, yeah, spirituality was that kind of guardrail that helped me to keep walking forward and feel safe. And that, I do think we all have our own journeys, like 100%. Like mine was embarrassing a great many times. I got on all kinds of high horses when I was young, my spiritual high horses. And like, God, I just was so obnoxious with my parents about like eating organic. And that was not a spiritual high horse, but I'd be like, you cannot shop at Walmart, you know? And it's like, we do that stuff in different ways. And so I'm not going to go back and go, oh, that was wrong. I was just where learning, you're at. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jack Kornfield will have the same thoughts. Yeah.
Jack Kornfield always has this funny story where he's like, he'll say something like, if Jesus of Nazareth went home to visit his parents, you don't think they would treat him like Jesus Christ? Like they would be like, listen, don't talk to me like you're above me. Like you're still my kid. Right. Or, you know, or Siddhartha or any of these. It's like, you know, we go home and we try to bring our stuff with us. And most of the time our family of origin is like, yeah, no, back up with that.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I'm glad that you spoke about that story. Cause I actually, similar to what you were thinking, Zinae, I had starred that because this concept of finding yoga as like a portal, I know for me was also my gateway into spirituality and connecting to self and all of these. And recently we actually had a friend of ours sent us this TikTok that we were talking about. And this woman was making this really interesting point around how a lot of the spiritual practices that we all know and, you know, we read and we take in have been written by, documented by, practiced by men, right? And she was talking about, and you should, you'll understand this as a new mother, specifically being a mother and what spirituality looks like as a mother and how that's so much different than and has never been captured by, let's say, 99% of the spiritual teachers that we know, right? And so she was saying, you know, even this concept of like meditating twice a day for 20 minutes, right? I know for me, the last few years, I have beat myself up so hard for losing my really rigid meditation practice once becoming a mother. And what she was saying is anybody who's a new mother would have said in any of those spiritual books, that's not possible. It's not realistic. My meditation is now breastfeeding. My meditation is now creating meals for my family. My meditation is now in the garden, right? And it just really opened my eyes to how I just have never thought about it in that way. And I guess it kind of lessened some of the shame for me.
I love that. And it's something I talk about and teach about as well. And it's been a huge part of my path, because when I was back in my namaste whites, you know, I was treating my body and my practice more as like that ascetic, right? Mm-hmm. Yogic way, which is not for the feminine form. I just had an interview and a chat with this woman, Brett Larkin, who is a yoga teacher. And she was saying that yoga was really meant for young boys who are going to become monastics, and then men who are leaving their jobs and becoming like ready to kind of pass on. And so it was like nowhere in there was it really for like just household people in a way back in the day. And I thought about it so many times. I mean, when I was in my first yogic community, that was like pretty intense. They were communal. They lived together and like shared communal clothes. It was kind of cultish, but I didn't join the cult. One of many cults I almost joined, but didn't. But we weren't allowed to sit on meditation cushions. Mm-hmm. And we were meditating in caves in Italy, like where St. Francis has meditated. And one time I was starting my period and I had the most insane cramps and I was cold and I'm sitting on this rock floor. And what I would do is I would put on like two extra sweaters. And then right before we all started to meditate, I would take them off and like try to make a cushion because my feminine body was not meant to just like, I should be laying down. I should be, you know, so it was when I was younger, I would treat myself as if, oh, I could be that kind of yogi. And then I was like, fuck that. I got into a lot more kind of earth-based, feminine, spiritual traditions. And that was a huge part of my journey as well in my 20s. It was just like, okay, I've explored that. What about over here where we're like using our little diva cups and we're putting blood on our, you know, plants with water. This was, you know, my 20-year-old self and, you know, free bleeding and doing rituals under the moon. And I mean, I would gather women in my yard and when I was in my early 20s and even in New York City, like I was like, it's Women's Day. We're going to all do a ritual around the Krishna tree. And, you know, so my own spiritual path ended up becoming more embodied, more based in, more inclusive to my feminine form, to my rhythms and cycles. And that's just been such an important part of my work too now is like, yeah, maybe it's not about meditation, sitting quietly. The work I do with women, we're usually like, you know, thrashing about, moaning and crying and screaming and moving in our sensual body. And we're using writing as an embodied creative spiritual practice. And that I always tell the women that I work with, I'm like, look, this is not one lineage. This is not one tradition. I'm not trained in this yoga thing. I decided not to take refuge with many Buddhist teachers. Like I have studied with these people. I have gone to these places, but I still, like you said, I still don't see that there's like some spiritual tradition out there that is inclusive of my feminine form in a really beautiful way. And so I'm going to keep dancing. I'm going to keep writing poetry. I'm going to keep crying. I'm going to keep screaming. I'm going to keep making love. I'm going to keep making amazing foods. And that's all going to be part of my feminine practice. And that's very different. And that is, I think this also, this really beautiful distinction is like, what the feminine practice includes the heart. Now, I'd like that to extend to everybody. But imagine the grandmothers teaching us, if our grandmothers had been free to be, you know, in that kind of more, let's say, earth-based witchy space, which our ancestors probably were, like imagine them teaching us. That would have been so full of love and heart, right? Like it's so I you know, I think that we're returning to that. Many people are like, oh, okay, like you said, what if my practice is nursing right now? I feel like my morning meditation when my daughter's napping on me for 2 hours, like that. I just love sitting in that love with her and just being quiet. I'm like, don't take this away from me. But yeah, it's a big journey, I think, for people when they find a spiritual path, especially women, and then to go, wait a minute, where's the embodied feminine here? Like, how does she live here? How does love run through my body? Like, where's my sensuality? Like, is that a spiritual practice? And there's just so much there, so much richness for each of us, which extends past our, you know, feminine form into all humans. But it does start with us. Like if we're not embodying that, then we can't necessarily walk through life transmitting that. So we have to reclaim it in ourselves first.
Yeah, I just love that. And I was having a realization even as you were speaking of like, what if our grandmothers were teaching us some of these practices. And I think I felt so struck by that because a lot of times I think it is almost like we skip the generation of our mothers are still like in a very like hustle culture or like, you know, striving way. For a lot of us, we grew up that way, but our grandmothers had slowed down enough that they were sort of coming in into the space of remembrance of their feminine. And there was just like so much, like permission giving around like who you are, I think with our grandmothers, like I kind of felt that in my body as you were speaking to it. And there's so many of the questions in your book, Alexander, like I highlighted, like there's like a way that you just give permission. I can read like the questions that you ask and like the reflections are like reflect on a time when you expressed your truth, even if it was messy or intense and it was actually a gift to the people around you. Like, I don't know why, like even reading those words made me feel emotional because I think there's just such a like, I don't want to be messy. Like, I got to figure this out like somewhere where I'm not going to be a burden to people. Like I hear that constantly from clients. And then so much of the time I have found when I'm my most messy, when I'm like exposing the dark, ugly bits or when I'm most of service to other people. And I think there's something in that that is just so healing to remind people of, right? Like, can you remember those times when you're actually supporting others by being in that, what I would call maybe our feminine, wild, messy truth, right?
Yeah. It's, I think we have these cultural collective wounds of like repression and getting it right and perfectionism and all these things that really hinder us from being fully expressed or being intimate and connected to one another, right? It's like, if I'm trying to get it right all the time with my partner, I'm in my head. I'm not in the present moment with him. I'm thinking about like how I could do it better, da, 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 instead of trying to drop into some feeling and express it. Now, I think a lot of us are being conscious. And so we think, well, I don't want to then go back to being unconscious where I'm just spurting my rage at my partner, right? Like, but what happens is like, there's a journey of, okay, now I'm conscious. Oh, I'm angry. So I could just be in my head trying to figure out how to be angry correctly, you know, or I could trust that I have a certain level of awareness now and express from that place openly, which is embarrassing because it's like, I mean, I say embarrassing in air quotes. It's like, okay, but now I'm like a civilized gal and like I've got a handle on my emotions and I've done all this therapy, but now I'm sitting here and I'm intellectualizing everything. And that's not very sexy or very intimate or very juicy or loving. So could I instead go, yeah, I'm feeling a lot of anger, and then just drop into my heart and an expression of that, like, oh, I'm so frustrated. Instead of, well, I'm really angry at you because I told you I don't like it when you did, you know? So it's like there is this part of our embodied like what I wrote in that prompt, it's like, that's a gift. It's a gift that calls my partner or my best friend into their body by me showing the emotion through my form instead of just talking about it. You know, it takes practice. It takes practice.
Oh my God. Yeah. You saw the first version of that. The first example is my almost 4-year-old. That's her. That's exactly what she sounds like when she's frustrated, the way she communicates, the, oh, I'm so frustrated, right? And this is, I mean, I'm going to try to articulate what's coming up for me, because I think what's really difficult, not just for myself, but I know for a lot of mothers, is when they get to that age and they communicate frustration mostly through whining, right? It's, that's like the number one way that they tend to communicate is through the whine. And I think societally, culturally, we have, you know, we weren't allowed to do that. It's very repressed in us. I have a very, I mean, I will speak for myself. I have a very hard time with her when she's in that space, right? I want her to communicate clearly. I want her to cut that shit out. I want her to, you know, be rational, all of these things, because it's overwhelming for me. It's flooding for me, right? It overwhelms my nervous system. But I love what you're saying about that way of expressing is actually a very embodied way of expressing, right? And I think for a lot of us, we're trying to come back to who we were at 4 years old. I mean, that's so many of the practices mm-hmm. we're doing, right? I know for me, when I talk to clients regularly, I'll say to them, you know, I use this term, like bring somebody along on the process, like bring them in on the process when you're experiencing something. And rather than saying, like you said, oh, I'm so angry, let me tell you why. It's more like my stomach is clenched, my teeth are clenched, my face is hot, like get into the sensation of it. Because a lot of times dropping into the sensation will bring us into that space of I'm so angry. Because a lot of times right. we don't even know I'm angry. I have no idea I'm angry. I just know that my teeth are clenched and my face is hot, right? Mm. So can you go yeah. that way? It's not like another yeah. portal, I guess.
I love that, because what you're doing is you're bringing yourself into the feeling and you're using words to get into the feeling. And then once you're in the feeling, you can feel it safely in the container of your marriage or wherever, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is the practice that is healing for many of us, is how do I get into that feeling safely, identifying it, and then being with it, not yeah. thinking through it, not intellectualizing it, not analyzing it. And, you know, I've had to work on this so much because, like you guys, I'm a smart woman. You know, I can like justify, I can be in a fight with my partner and be like, well, let me tell you why you're wrong, truly. And, it, you know, it's that silly adage, would you rather be, you know, right, or with whatever the other option is, would you rather be love, happy. Right? It's so happy. Whatever. Yeah.
Happy. These are my choices.
Yeah. But for me, it's had to be like a crucible of my ego getting like just squashed to be like, okay, I'm not going to be right. And I'm just going to feel, and I'm just going to let the tears drop out of my eyes. And so my partner can be invited into, like Danae, you were saying, that little piece that I wrote, invited into the experience. And that brings them into their bodies. And then we're intimately connected. Whereas if I withhold those tears, maybe because I don't know they're there waiting for me, or I can't find them, then we stay potentially disconnected. And it's hard and it's messy. And I don't succeed at this, obviously, all the time, you know, and I don't think anybody does. But to have a practice where we try to do that with the people that we love, or at least in our intimate relationships. And for me, you know, the kind of the dyadic relationship with masculine feminine has its own particular flavor. My partner, it offers him something that he may not be able to offer me as often in the same way, because I have a really great access to my soft heart and my tears and my vulnerabilities. So it's also, that's part of the gift giving, let's say, for him, is that my tears become an invitation where then he wants to hold me and like be like, oh, I'm here, versus my
right.
sharp words. The words I get really sharp, let's say.
same, girl.
But I think what you're saying is so important. And I want to like stay here for just a second with the distinction, because what I find so often, certainly within myself, but with so many of the couples that I work with, is that we do the intellectual conversation around what's happening or where you are not meeting my needs as a way I find to defend against really dropping into the felt experience of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think so much of that ends up being a little of what you were saying, V, that like, we were so shamed for the bigness of our feelings that it's like, I need you to justify why I feel this, or I need your yes. buy-in for me to feel feelings, right? And mm-hmm. if I can't get your buy-in, then I don't get to feel, right? But there's something, and you're not even like saying the words, there's just like an embodied experience of the way you're describing it, Alexandra, that's like, I am with myself in these feelings. I'm not apologizing for it. I'm not right. looking for your validation.
Right.
I'm just feeling all of this, and that that becomes in like almost a, I want you to say it, like
an invitation is what I love the word. Yeah. But if you have another partner, one. Yeah.
No, but yeah. I think that's real. What you're saying is like, it's an invitation to your partner to get back into that innate sense of like knowing how to be present with you versus like, I'm going to like convince you or shame you or criticize the way you're doing life, which I find just like shuts the partner down. And then they're just defending themselves, you know?
Totally. I find this a lot in the car. So we have a lot of car dynamics in my relationship. I'm like, it's been since the beginning. And so at first I'd be like, hey, you're driving too fast. Like you're driving past the speed limit. It's too fast, you know, and for years I would try to correct, you know, like using my judgment and like, am I right or wrong? Now I just go, I'm scared because yeah, I actually am scared underneath it. And I'll say, I'm scared. And I feel completely juvenile and silly, you know, but it is the truth. It's like, I am actually scared that we're going to get into an accident. So I could, you know, and it's, I give women permission. I'm like, look, give yourself permission to get a little dramatic, right? Like you're not doing this. We're not doing it in the four-year-old way because we have consciousness, awareness. We have a different kind of cognitive understanding than they do. So it may look like that, but we're aware and we're making a choice around it. And so I tell that to women. I'm like, if I'm working with a woman and she's trying to help her express something, you know, sensual or anger or something, I'm like, okay, that's a level two. Like, what does your level 10 look like? And let's play with that range for you. And everybody has their edge, right? It's just like someone's edge is like someone's 10 is someone's two and vice versa. Yeah. But I think that a lot of us can use the practice of stretching it open a little bit more with awareness, right? We're not like throwing plates at our, you know, husbands for fun.
Even though sounds we want to fun. Sometimes. Yeah. I had like a visceral reaction when you said you're at a two, bring it to a 10. I felt my body be like, oh, nope, don't want to do that. Don't want to go to a 10, right? And I was thinking how that word dramatic was used as such an insult and such a way to kind of control me and my emotions when I was little. And I know for a lot of us girls, women, it was. And so even hearing the word like, oh, we need to get dramatic, it just brings up such a visceral response, right? Because I just hear my mom over and over and over again telling me, stop being so dramatic and all those words. And it's really hard to go back to what a lifetime of kind of shaming us out of this thing, you know?
Totally. And when I'm like doing practices with women and it's like, I'm asking them to express, I'll walk around and I'll say like, you know, if I was your partner, I would have no idea what's going on inside of you. Like, what if you turn it up a little bit and a little bit so that we learn to get back into our bodies, to get back into the expression that we've been shamed out of or that we've been intellected out of, right? We've been sort of praised as Western, maybe American women or whatever. We've been praised of being smart and together and da 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 da. I mean, I will use different kind of archetypal. I know you guys have that kind of depth psychology background, but I'll use different archetypal expressions to help women get into some of these parts and pieces that maybe are already a little bit expressed in a way that is different than we're not usually allowed. And that can be really fun and helpful and kind of freeing in a way, which brings in my acting background too, but it takes practice. I mean, I still find myself totally going stone face and a moment of pain or sadness. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, wow, my partner has no idea what's going on inside of me, you know? And sometimes that's all I got. Sometimes then I can have one deep breath where I go, oh, and then he can feel me a little bit, you know, and that's just one step. So that's like, if you think about the range of like closure, heart is not expressed, I'm in fear or some sort of a trauma response or whatever it is, to I can take a breath, make just a little sound, to then 2 years later, I was like, ah, you're the four-year-old. But it's also sexy, I think, at a certain point, you know, maybe not whining, but like the expression, you know.
Yeah. I love that you give access points or entry points to give people access to this, women access to this? Because I think Vanessa and I run a lot of retreats and, you know, I would say there was certainly a period for me where I had realized like, I've been repressing so much. And I was like in my like wild feminine, like I'm going to be naked all the time and I don't give a shit. Everybody can. And Vanessa was like, Danae, you're scaring people. Like you've got to like a little bit, but I think that it can feel a little bit destabilizing to jump right into the like, just feel, don't care, like make a mess, like whatever. And I think I love the way you speak to, can we use some of these archetypal stories or images or ways of playing with like a little step in that direction so it doesn't feel just so jarring in the way that some of us might be jarring to others.
Totally. And I have like a cringy.
I don't know
like,
what you're talking about today.
It can become performative, right? Yeah. It can become also not honoring of every woman's experience because not every woman wants to get naked on a retreat, you know, like I've never gotten naked on a retreat. But then last year I offered like a, we're going to go swimming in this river if you feel inspired, but it's no pressure, you know, and I thought, God, this is the first time I'm bringing nudity into a retreat experience. But what I did was I had people be in pairs, like kind of dispersed. So it wasn't like just like everyone, you know, I don't know. My partner was like, me and the men go naked cold plunging every day. And I was like, I was like, okay, fine. We're going to do some cool naked stuff too. But it ended up being that like there was enough of safety because it was like the fourth day of retreat. There was enough space and privacy that everyone ended up getting naked. And, you know, and that, but I would never want to force someone that, you know, because it, or force someone to feel really big feelings if it relates to their trauma. And I definitely encouraged women at a certain time. And I had a great client who was like, it's not safe for me to feel this. And I was like, what do you mean? At that time, I hadn't really studied enough kind of trauma-informed conversation. And, and you know, it's sweet. That client is still a friend of mine and she's a therapist. And she taught me that in that moment of like, you can't force a woman to open past or too quickly, or it's like making love or something. You can't force yourself to just boom, be open. Like it may just be like, oh, just a little. And that titration is important as well, especially if we don't know why someone has closed, right? Whether it's in love or as a facilitator. It's like, well, I don't know what someone is holding, why their heart is closed or why their body is closed. And so I can offer, again, like invitations and opportunities to open a little, but that also honor different people's experiences in the room.
I love that. Yeah. I use the image when
and
I
for
start.
For the record, sorry.
Yeah, not trying to.
I've never gotten naked on retreat. I just don't want to be scared of coming to our retreats. Please continue, V. But I don't get naked, people.
That's true. Don't be scared. Come to our retreats.
Dramatic.
Danae's not forcing anybody to get naked. Don't worry.
You will not be forced to get naked. Please carry on. Sorry.
There are some retreats where that happens, though.
That's true.
None of us here.
Yeah. None of us. No forcing to get naked. Don't worry. No, I was just saying. I was thinking about how in the beginning of my relationships with clients, the image I always use is, you know, especially people who have never done any kind of processing or therapy work. And I always say, like, you know, there's so much fear when people come in because there's this image. I say it's like this overly stuffed suitcase. There's this fear that people have that you're going to reach in and get the thing on the bottom and you're going to pull it out and then the whole thing's going to explode, right? And I always say, I'm like, that's not how we do this. We start from the top and we fold things and we put them away. And then eventually we will get to the stuff that's in the bottom of the suitcase, but we're not just going to reach in and grab it and yank it out because that's not helpful. It just makes a huge mess. Everything explodes everywhere, right? And then you got to clean it up. And when I use that image, I find people really like, oh, okay, that I can handle. You know, it's like, I can go there. Now I'm looking forward to getting in there and getting into the bottom because it's going to be a process. And I know that you've got it contained and I know that you know what you're doing, you know? So it's like, we're the end goal is the same, but there's a process in which we get there that feels safe and containing.
Yeah. I think that's the responsible way to do it. And I mean, I see people blowing themselves open. I have to myself at different moments, but especially like with psychedelics and plant medicines, just like going straight to the bottom of that suitcase and then kind of getting shot out back into their life. Like, what? So I definitely feel like the lasting work for me as well has been like the slow and steady with like a mentor who's just tracking the nuance with me as well, and not asking me to just blow past edges all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a balance. I mean, a little. Yep. A little edge play.
Push, a little push. Yeah. Can I ask you, so just a question straight out of the book, because I think this is really important for people to hear you say, you know, why are emotions part of the spiritual path? Like, I think this is really important. I know we've been talking about it in our own way, but I kind of want to give people a very pointed answer to that, because I think this is like one of the crux of your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I see emotions as part of the essential language of connection and love, which is part of our embodied experience, right? Like we're here in an interrelational dimension, if you will, of connection. Emotions hold a lot of energy. We all know that. We can attest to that. So we can spend a life avoiding them, or we can become artful with them and use them as tools to access a deeper place within ourselves. Mm-hmm. A lot of the tantric spiritual traditions, and I'm differentiating tantric between neo-tantric, which is like sort of modern Western co-opting and shifting around of tantra for sexual kind of experience. But a lot of the ancient tantric lineages that originated in Tibet and India and in the East, part of the emotional experience coming into spirituality is dealing with energy that is charged, that is difficult, right? So it's like it's like that phrase of emotions being like wild horses. So we can either try to avoid those, or we become artful at working with them, letting them open us, feeling them, pouring them into our life as art, and letting that be a vehicle to awakening. Pema Chodron talks about this a ton. So she talks about emotions as a huge part of the spiritual path, not being attached to them, you know, not getting kind of, let's say, possessed by them, but also letting them open you, letting them take you to a place, being with them in a certain way. And especially, and this is something that she talks about, like having a broken, open heart. So letting that grief open your heart and be a way that then you connect to all of humanity, the universality of human experience, right? We feel that through emotions, the empathy that we can cultivate. We can't feel empathy for each other or compassion for each other if we can't feel, and if we can't feel our life and ourselves. So it becomes a spiritual tool and a part of a spiritual path. And there's another great spiritual teacher who created the Gene Keys, Richard Rudd. He says in one of his books, he has this kind of sequence called the Venus sequence, and it's a path of opening the heart. And he says there's two essential spiritual paths. One is through meditation and one is through love. Mm-hmm. And that the meditation one is the one we were talking about, that was the more traditionally masculine path. To me, the path of love is in another way that we deeply awaken to, I'm you and you're me. And like, there is no separation here. If I'm feeling myself and if I have the capacity to feel into you, then how could I hurt you? Right. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I feel like is so necessary on our planet, and that isn't a skill that we've been taught, you know, beyond all the kind of spiritual stuff, just our capacity to feel compassion and empathy for each other and not to be separate. So I guess it's a complex answer to how the emotions kind of factor into our spiritual path and into our path of love and connection with each other. But learning to be artful with them and not afraid of them, to me, is so important and so fun and exciting. Like, the greatest art that we've all experienced is full of emotion. Mm-hmm. The soul's journey, right, is marked by these emotional realms, the dips into grief and the, you know, escalations into ecstasy and joy. So when we hold back or withhold or avoid those places because we're scared, we are avoiding our life and avoiding love and avoiding our soul's work, which not everybody cares about, but I do. And so if you look at your life like a song, like what are those tones and textures that you're living into? And I always love, it's like the language of your soul is going to come through in those moments, right? When you're weeping and laughing and loving, maybe not, maybe when you're ideating and analyzing, but you know, those usually aren't the ones that we record on our inner kind of map of our life. It's like the ones that we can deeply feel. So why aren't we turning towards that every day? Totally.
Oh. Alexandra, you are an absolute treasure. I am so thrilled to make your acquaintance. Thank you. And yeah, I just want to sit here and listen to you speak for hours. I want to be mindful of our time. So I'm going to jump into our lightning round of questions.
Okay.
The first question that we always ask is, who have been your greatest teachers, whether they are people, you spoke to it a little bit, but people who you've really appreciated their work or people who have impacted your path from knowing them?
Well, so I mentioned Bobby and then Deborah Kentmeyer, who is a teacher of mine at NYU, and she's now a TV and film director and producer in Hollywood. But also some of the writers, David Data's work has been really important to me. My partner worked with him for 8 years and studied with him, and his work has been really important. Marianne Woodman, who I know you guys know, her work has been really important to me. A lot of the poets and the mystical poets, definitely deeply impacted. I mean, I got lots of that, but I'll leave those at that. Yeah.
Love it. So we talk sometimes about this concept of, you know, some might call it flow. Some might call it, you know, tapping into that higher state. What does flow look like for you, right? Like, what are you doing when you find that you're so aligned that you kind of lose track of everything?
These days, sensual movement and dance. Like I grew up dancing and ballet and like I was strict kind of for a long time. And then I've just reclaimed my practice of finding my sensuality through movement the last few years. I mean, I was always a wild dancer from the samba to booty shanking in Atlanta, Georgia when I was 12, you know. That's how I got asked to prom by a senior. I was a freshman. So I've always found God through shaking my booty. But it's come back again. I had to sort of reevaluate my relationship to my sexuality and kind of, you know, do a lot of healing in that regard. So then it felt like, ooh, am I ready to dive back into that type of expression? Well, now it's private. I do it at home. I'm not posting those kind of things and like whatever. But I do find that I'm just going into like these yummy, deep, pleasureful states through sensual movement and dance. And I'm bringing that into my teaching too. And it's so beautiful to take our bodies out of the rigidity that we experience just like sitting at the computer all the time. So yeah, definitely going into that. Yeah.
I love that. I just went to go visit a girlfriend of mine recently and we had like one of those, let's be 20 years old again and go out dancing all night. And it was so healing and so, I mean, oh my God, I just, for days I was buzzing and I was just so in my body. And, but it was that, it was like that sensual, you know, shake your booty kind of dancing, but it was just her and I, and it was just, oh, cannot express how healing it was to do. Amazing.
Totally. Yeah. We can't become too like sort of smart and like polished that we forget to do that, roll around on the floor together. Yeah.
And what breaks your heart, Alexandra?
Whew. I mean, I sit and contemplate, especially when I'm just sitting all these hours with my daughter breastfeeding or she's asleep on me, just how, like, what is evil and how does it exist and what do we do about it? And what do we do about these people that are so hurt that they bring about so much violence onto others? And like, why has it happened throughout time? Like, did it ever start where people started doing it, and or has it always been a part of human nature to like rape and kill? And it's mind-boggling to me when I think about the existential nature of good and evil and like if there's a way out of it, you know, because that's what my life is geared towards, that there is a way out of it. Like I promise people, let's heal, let's make sure we're not passing on our traumas and our addictions and all of these things. And so I'm like, what is the nature of this, you know? And I just, it's terrifying being a parent and just feeling the contrast on this planet of the most dark, evil, painful realities that I can't hold in my body, you know? And then the most beauty. And I mean that, yeah, that's the most perplexing thing that I cannot explain. I don't have an answer for. I just try to feel as much as I can without hurting myself. Yeah. And when I get to the other side, I have a lot of questions.
Same.
Yeah.
Okay. So the final question is, what is your favorite food?
Oh, you guys, I have not eaten oysters in approximately 1 year because I was pregnant,
well, pregnant
and then I gave birth. And today, since it's my pub day, do you know what my man did last night? He drove to buy oysters, a bushel of oysters. So right now in the fridge are oysters on ice, which he will be shucking for me with some champagne. And champagne. Yeah, that's like my jam, which obviously I didn't have for a very long time.
Oysters and champagne. We have not gotten that one yet. So I look at food as part of my spirituality. So I think it's important to tap into
that. It is. And they're very sensual oysters, you know, and they have lots of nutrients in them too. So highly recommend at some point, you know, you can have a fake champagne if you don't drink champagne, but to sit and sip and sip and slurp.
Well,
Alexandra, I feel like what a sacred invitation. I love the way that you speak to being in feelings and how did you say, artful, but not afraid. I think it's just, there's so much about the way that you are showing up in the world and speaking and embodying so much of what you're talking about that is just really inspiring. So thank you for coming and sharing some of that with us. Delighted to know you. And, where it's can the, people?
It's yeah, the pub day.
Like, we're both like, hey, y'all. We're just looking at you guys.
Thank you.
But if people want some more, where can they get some more?
Well, my book Dare to Feel is out. Please go buy it. The audio version is me talking, and it's really fun. I had so much fun reading that, and there's all these poems and things. So, I would definitely get the audio. The written one, though, has lots of things for you to underline and fill in. So get both if you can. My first book, Fuck Like a Goddess, is also really a good book, a fun book. It's really, I'm proud of that one too. So, and then I also have like a kind of limited edition podcast for Dare to Feel with some great people on it. I'm on Instagram. You can find me there at Alexandra Roxo. My website is also my name. I see clients one-on-one. I do group mentorship and practice and retrets as well. So yeah.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much.
This is a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Cheaper Than Therapy.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share it with a friend, subscribe, and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And if you want to connect with us more, find us on Instagram at Cheaper Than Therapy, the podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.